Hi, everyone. This is Scott Shapiro. This is episode two, class two of the Jurisprudence podcast course that I put together. Bunch of people wrote in saying that I should have intros and outros music for the podcast. So I figured, you know, what song represents analytical jurisprudence, and it's just restless rock and roll spirit. And I thought, of course, Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. I grew up in New Jersey and listened to Bruce Springsteen all through my childhood. I have to say, I mean, I loved Bruce. I hated New Jersey. Miserable, miserable place to grow up. I wasn't the most popular kid in school till the end of high school. I was a very early adopter of social distancing and what I might now call lighter friending. All the cool kids at the time, they made the basketball team and they wore Lacoste shirts. And well, I just want to ask, who has a podcast now, huh? Actually, probably everyone has a podcast. I think I'm like the last person to start one. But who has a jurisprudence podcast? Pretty sure I'm the only one. So I think I win. Speaking of social distancing, public service announcement, please do not leave your house except for essential reasons. Please don't socialize. And if I hear that you are, I'm just warning you, it's going to affect your grade. I hate to do it, but I mean, we're in the middle of the coronavirus crisis, and we really have to do our parts. Thanks to everyone for giving me feedback on episode one. Also, for people who suggested I get a better microphone, I got a big microphone. Really excited. I feel really, really important using it. So what we're going to do today is we're going to ask three questions or discuss three topics. I'm going to split the episode into three parts. The first part, part one, will be what is the question, what is law? Like, what do we mean when we ask that question, what is law? Part two will be the nature of legal facts. And part three will be the debate between legal positivism and natural law. So let's start with part one. By the way, we'll have an intermission between each part. So each part will be about 15, 20 minutes or something like that. And that way you can press pause on the podcast and then pick it up for the next part where we talk about a different topic. Okay, so let's begin by asking, in the last episode, I talked about how analytical jurisprudence has traditionally been concerned with the question, what is law? So what I'd like to do now is talk about what do we mean, what is law? And I have to say, a lot of people, when they hear that jurisprudence is concerned with, obsessed with maybe the question, what is law, they think it's a stupid thing, stupid question to spend all of our time discussing. In part, I think, because they think that what is law is really what is, quote, law. That is, the question really is a question about a meaning of the word law. So as if legal philosophy is an attempt to try to understand what the meaning of the term law is. Now, a lot of people think this, not just students or law professors. I mean, Ronald Dworkin in Law's Empire claimed that Hart was interested in what he called a semantic theory of law, that is an attempt to understand what the word law means. Now, it's unfortunate that people think this, and that some legal philosophers have claimed that this is what we all are engaged in, in part because it's just not a particularly interesting question. It's not an interesting question because, well, first, law is an English word. So, like, why is legal philosophy obsessed with trying to figure out the meaning of an English word? And there are lots of other languages, infinite number of possible languages. Each one could have multiple terms for law. So why would we spend all our time talking about an English term? That's the first thing. Second thing is that the word law is you know, it's a very capacious word. It applies to things that we wouldn't consider to be law in the sense of legal rules. So we talk about Boyle's law or Charles's law or the law of excluded middle, lots of things. Mathematics has laws, physics has laws, grammar. So grammar has certain types of laws. I mean, nobody's interested in figuring out, well, I should say no legal philosopher is interested in figuring out what that word means in all of its contexts. We're interested in legal institutions and the usages of law in those contexts. So it wouldn't make sense to spend all our time on a semantic question about the meaning of the term law. What we're really interested in when we ask the question, what is law, is we want to know the nature of the thing that's pointed to, that's referred to by the word law or by any other word in another language that also points to what the English word points to. That is, what we're interested in is the nature of legal institutions, the nature of legal rules, the nature of legal rights. Okay, so it's not, what is law is not a semantic question, but if you will, a metaphysical question. It's an attempt to really understand the nature of law and legal institutions. Okay, so let's start by talking about what does it mean to ask the question, what is the nature of something? Philosophers do this all the time. Plato in the Republic asks, you know, what is knowledge? What's the nature? I'm sorry. What is justice? What's the nature of justice? Philosophers, epistemologists talk about what is the nature of knowledge? What is the nature of meaning? Philosophers have always been concerned with the nature of things. And so what are they concerned with when they're interested in the nature of something? Well, let's distinguish between two possibilities. The first is when they ask, what is the nature of knowledge or justice? That what they're interested in is the identity of knowledge or justice. They want to know what makes knowledge knowledge and not something else, or what makes justice justice and not something else. That is, we want to know, what is it about the thing that makes it the thing that it is and not something else? So the old answer to what is knowledge used to be, knowledge is true, justify belief. So the properties of knowledge which make it knowledge is that it's true, that it's justified, and that it's a belief. Sometimes philosophers call these the essential properties of an object. That is, those things that the possession of which makes the thing that it is and not something else. Okay, so when we ask about the nature of something, we could be asking about its identity, that is, about its essence, its essential properties, what makes it the thing that it is and not something else. But when we ask about the nature of something, we could be interested in another question, which sounds very similar, but it's actually significantly different. And that is, we're interested in the necessary properties of the thing. We want to know what necessarily follows, what are the necessary implications of the fact that something is what it is and not something else. So we can ask about the nature of knowledge as what's necessarily true of knowledge, or what's necessarily true of justice or just acts or unjust acts. What properties does the thing have which it could not fail to have? So the identity question, the first one we talked about, that is interested in it, in the essential properties of the thing. In the second interpretation of the nature question, what we are interested in is the necessary implications. That is, what's necessarily true of the thing? Don't worry if you don't understand or get the difference between essential properties and necessary properties, that they sound really similar. Let me give you an example. Hopefully, we'll clarify the difference. Take the number three. The number three, what makes the number three the number three? What characterizes its identity, its essence? Well, it's the number that comes after two. Really, that's the only thing that makes three three. it's the number that comes after 2. It's a successor of 2. But of course, there are many, many properties that 3 has, which are necessarily true of 3, which don't contribute to its being the number 3. So for example, 3 is odd, or 3 is a divisor of 9, or 3 is 5 numbers below 8. Those are all necessary properties of the number 3, but they don't characterize its identity. Its identity, its essence, is captured by the fact that it's the number that comes after 2. So mathematicians, number theorists, when they're interested in numbers, they're not just interested in their identity. It's pretty straightforward to understand their identity. Just have to know where they come in the order of numbers. But they're interested in the necessary properties that it has, and that's what they spend their time doing. So similarly, when legal philosophers, when they ask what is law, understood as what is the nature of law, they may have one of two questions in mind. And in fact, they typically have both in mind. One is they want to know about the identity of law. They want to know what makes law law. What properties constitute its essence? And they also want to know what necessarily follows from the fact that something is law. That is, what are the necessary properties of law? What properties could law not fail to have? Legal philosophers are interested in both of those questions, but what we'll see in the next part is that really so much of the work and the goal of analytical jurisprudence is really to figure out what necessarily follows from the fact that something is law. They want to understand the identity of law, of course, but what they want to do is, once they get the answer to the question, what makes a law law, they want to figure out what necessarily follows from that. And that is what we will talk about in the next part. And let me give us an outro. Okay, we are back. Part 2 of class 2. It'd be really cool if when I teach class, if I could just like teach for 14 minutes and then just call an intermission and then go take a walk, hang out with my wife or something, and then come back an hour and a half later and then continue. So I'm kind of liking this podcasting flexibility. Okay, let's start here with the nature of legal facts. Okay, what is a legal fact? A legal fact is just a fact about the existence of a legal system or its content. So, for example, it is a legal fact that Bulgaria has a legal system. It's also the case that in California, it is the law that you are not permitted, that drivers are not permitted to drive more than 65 miles per hour. Those are two legal facts. There are many, many legal facts out there. That's all I mean by when I talk about legal facts. Now, the thing about a legal fact is it has a very interesting property, which is that all legal facts are never metaphysically basic. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that whenever a legal system exists, or a law exists, or a legal obligation or legal right exists, it always does so in virtue of some other fact or facts. So here's a way to think about it. If you were to make a list of all the ultimate facts of the universe, that is, all the metaphysically basic facts, the list would consist of the laws of physics, whatever subatomic particles physicists think are fundamental, space-time, the existence of magnetic fields or whatever, you see a lot of facts which are just kind of just brute there. One of the things you're not going to see is that it's against the law in California to drive more than 65 miles per hour, or that Bulgaria has a legal system. Those legal facts would not be part of any list of the ultimate facts in the universe, but would rather be, if you will, built on those facts, or built on facts that are built on those facts. Is that this is some way in which legal facts are not metaphysically basic, but are, as we'll say, depend upon for their existence their relationship to other more basic facts. Just very simple-mindedly, you might say, well, why is it against the law in California to drive more than 65 miles per hour? Well, because some people did some things in the past, and that's what made it the case that it's against the law to drive more than 65 miles per hour. Like what? Like that people wrote things down on a piece of paper and then got together in this thing called the California legislature, and they voted on it, and that it was signed by the governor or something. I don't know exactly how it works. You don't need to know how exactly it works, but you can imagine that, like, there are those more basic facts in the world which constitute legal facts. And what makes it the case that Bulgaria has a legal system? Well, that there are Bulgarian judges, and that there are Bulgarian legislatures, and that there are Bulgarian police officers, and yada, yada, yada. Okay? So one of the things that we really want to know in legal philosophy is we want to know what facts, legal facts, depend on. You know what? I'm sorry, I have to shut off my music in the background. Sorry about that. So what we want to know is, what facts do legal facts depend on? Now, we can think of two possibilities. I mean, there are many, many, many possibilities, but really two live possibilities. The first one is that they depend on social facts alone. What do I mean by that? I mean, they depend on the fact that people got together and they did certain things and they said certain things and they intended certain things. Some kind of fact about social groups makes it the case that California has outlawed driving more than 65 miles per hour, that Bulgaria has a legal system. In the case of California, it's that the legislature in the passed an ordinance, which was then signed by the governor. So it's that those facts, those social facts. And Bulgaria is the fact that they have certain types of arrangements, so police enforcing rules made by the legislature and then adjudicated by judges. So we have one possibility, which is that legal facts, because they're not metaphysically basic, they are grounded in more basic facts, which are social in nature. That's one possibility, that legal facts depend on social facts alone. Another possibility is that legal facts depend not just on social facts, but also on moral facts. That is, they depend on certain truths about morality. For example, why is it the case that it is against the law to drive over 65 miles per hour in California? It's not simply the case that the legislature and the governor signed an ordinance prohibiting that kind of driving. It's that, morally speaking, people in California ought to listen to what the legislature and governor says, because, I don't know, maybe that they were democratically elected and that there's a moral obligation to heed representatives who have democratic legitimacy. Or it may be that it's just better to have rules on certain basic areas of life. And so once they're set, we have a moral obligation to obey them. The point is, whatever facts, moral facts, ground law, the second possibility assumes that social facts alone cannot ground law. We also need moral facts. So now we have two possibilities: that legal facts are grounded on social facts alone. The second possibility is that legal facts are grounded not just in social facts, but also in moral facts. Okay, those are two possibilities. Now notice, whichever possibility is in fact the case, they can't both be true. It's either one or the other. Whichever is true turns out to be a necessary truth about the law. Let's say the first possibility is true. Let's say that legal facts ultimately depend on social facts. It would be a necessary truth that legal facts depend on social facts alone. We could say that it's a necessary property of law that legal facts are ultimately grounded in social facts. Okay, so why is this important? This is important because if and when legal philosophers are able to answer the question, what are the necessary properties of law, part of that answer will contain the answer to which of these two possibilities are true. That is, in the list of necessary properties of law, we'll find out either that legal facts depend on social facts alone, or that legal facts depend on social and moral facts as well. In part one, I said that the question of what is law was not a semantic question, but rather a question about the identity of law and its necessary implications about its nature in both senses. We can start to see why those questions start to matter. They start to matter because once we understand the identity of law, we can start figuring out what's necessarily true about law. And once we start figuring out what is necessarily true about law, we can start understanding which of the two possibilities I raised is the right one. That is, we can figure out whether legal facts depend on social facts alone or on moral facts as well. Now, why does it matter which of these two possibilities are correct? Well, it matters because if the first possibility is true, then legal reasoning will not involve moral reasoning. Why? Because, well, ultimately, moral facts don't ground legal facts. If we want to know, for example, how to interpret the Constitution, or what's the right way to understand legal texts which are passed by the California legislature, we have to know what ultimately grounds legal facts. And if legal facts are ultimately grounded by social facts, then we shouldn't engage in moral theorizing about what's legitimate if we want to know how to interpret the law or what the law is. We should just engage in sociological inquiry and figure out which social facts are the important social facts which ground law, and that way we can figure out what the law is. We can figure out what the legal facts are. However, if the second possibility is true, and that legal facts ultimately depend on moral facts as well, then the only way that we're ever going to figure out what the law is, especially in cases that involve a deep interpretive controversies, we're going to have to make reference to moral reasoning, because legal facts depend on moral facts as well. What I'd like to do in part three is show how the debate between legal positivists and natural lawyers can be seen as being a debate about which of these two possibilities are right. And so we will, let me give a nice outro. Okay, this is part three of the Jurisprudence Podcast. Don't worry, even I think I'm going overboard with this intro, outro music stuff, and I'm probably going to get sued anyway. So let's see how whether this survives episode two. Okay, let's talk about the debate between legal positivism and natural law theory. My first lecture in law school, I remember, that is when I was a law student, the lecturer talked about this thing called legal positivism, and he said that there was it was a very controversial doctrine, and that I would be hearing a lot about it as a law student throughout my law career. For the next few years, I never heard the phrase again. But of course, legal positivism is a big deal in legal scholarship and natural law theory as well. And so we'll be talking about that right now. And of course, I mean, so much of this, the course will be about that debate. Let me preface my description by saying that people use the phrase legal positivism or natural law theory in many, many different ways. I mean, in international law, when people talk about positivistic approaches, they mean something very different than what legal philosophers mean when they say positivistic, and they call a theory positivistic. So what I'm going to do is characterize what legal philosophers mean when they talk about legal positivism and natural law theory, not what everyone means by it. Okay, let's begin by saying that the debate between legal positivism and natural law theory is a debate about what ultimately grounds legal facts. The legal positivist believes that legal facts are ultimately dependent on social facts, never on moral facts. Whereas the natural lawyer believes that legal facts depend not just ultimately on social facts, but on moral facts as well. So take John Austin, which we will discuss in the next episode. So John Austin thought that ultimately law depends on power. How it depends on power we'll discuss, but the idea is that law, what makes a legal fact is that it has certain relationship to brute political power. Now, that's a positivistic view because brute political power is just a social fact in the world. It just is the case. Where somebody like, let's say, Ronald Dworkin, who thinks that legal facts ultimately depend on moral facts as well, he's going to say that what makes the law, what makes it the case that the law is a certain way in a particular jurisdiction depends not just on what political actors have done, but about deep truths about moral philosophy. You could see why the debate between legal positivism and natural law theory would matter. As I said in part two, if you thought the first possibility was true and that legal facts ultimately depend on social facts alone, then if you wanted to know what the legal facts were in a particular jurisdiction, you would not engage in moral theorizing because that would be irrelevant to what the law is. It might be relevant to whether you ought to obey the law, but it would be strictly irrelevant to what the law is. Whereas if you were a natural lawyer and you thought that legal facts ultimately depend on moral facts as well, then in order to know what the law is, you would have to engage in some form of moral philosophy. Maybe not, very deep and hard questions about moral philosophy, but they may involve questions about moral philosophy nonetheless, though very difficult legal cases may, in fact, depend on very difficult moral questions. If you're a natural lawyer, you think that that's what law ultimately depends on, so you'd have to engage in the very inquiry that is demanded by the answer to the question, what do legal facts ultimately depend on? I just want to end by bringing everything back to the beginning of the episode, where we talked about the question, what is law? The debate between legal positivists and natural lawyers, as we said, is a debate about what facts do legal facts ultimately depend on, social facts or moral facts as well. Now, the debate, the question about what facts do legal facts ultimately depend on is a debate about the necessary properties of law. So legal positivists and natural lawyers are having a debate about what the necessary properties of law are. Therefore, they're having a debate about the nature of law, and therefore, they're having a debate about the question, what is law? So I hope you see how this all comes together. The reason why what is law is taken to be a kind of an organizing question of analytical jurisprudence is because it concerns the nature of law, the identity and the necessary implications of law, and that's why one of the main debates in legal philosophy in analytical jurisprudence is between legal positivists and natural lawyers, because they're debating about what the necessary properties of law are, and so therefore they're having a debate about what the nature of law is. Okay, so hopefully that made sense. What we're going to do in the next episode is we're going to begin with the positivistic theory of John Austin, the 19th century English legal theorist. We could have started with Plato or Hobbes or Aquinas. Traditionally, courses in jurisprudence start with Austin. I think, as we'll see, it makes sense because Austin's theory is very intuitive. It's very easy to figure out and to learn, but it's also very easy to criticize. This is a really, really helpful, I think, place to start an inquiry into the nature of law. So we will be doing that next. Next episode. Let me find my iPhone here so I can give us some nice outro music. Okay, I got a good one here. Here we go.